Dr. Pitt. Of course, no 17th-century code is a match for high-speed computers, and our specialists should have it cracked any day now.
So how much is supposed to be done there? Hatch managed to ask.
Good question. We know the cargo capacity of Occam's ships. We know they were fully laden, and we have manifests from many of the ships he attacked. Did you know that he was the only pirate to successfully attack the Spanish plate fleet?
No,
murmured Hatch. When you add it all up, the most conservative estimate places the contemporary value of the treasure at... Needleman paused, a trace of a smile on his lips. Between $1.8 and $2 billion. There was a long silence, filled by the throbbing of the engine, the monotonous wheeling of the gulls, and the sound of the boat moving through the water. Hatch struggled to grasp the enormity of the sum. Needleman lowered his voice. That is, not including the value of St. Michael's sword, Occam's greatest prize. For a moment the spell was broken.
Come on, Captain, Hatch said with a laugh. Don't tell me you believe such a mossy old legend.
Not until I read McAllen's journal.
Dr. Hatch,
it is there. McAllen watched them bury it with the treasure.
Hatch stared unseeing at the deck, his mind a turmoil. This is incredible. Almost beyond belief.
He glanced up and felt the muscles of his gut tighten involuntarily. The countless questions that had risen within him suddenly evaporated. Across the expanse of sea, he could now make out the long, low fog that concealed Ragged Island, the same fog bank that had lain on the island more than 25 years before. He heard Needleman next to him saying something. He turned, breathing shallowly, trying to quiet his beating heart.
I'm sorry?
I said, I know you have little interest in the money, but I wanted you to know that in the agreement I've proposed here, you would receive half the treasure, before expenses. In return for my undertaking all the financial risk, I will receive St. Michael's sword. Your share would therefore be in the vicinity of $1 billion.
Hatch swallowed. You're right. I couldn't care less.
There was a long pause. Then Needleman raised his binoculars and examined the island of fog. Why does it remain fog-bound?
There's a good reason, Hatch said, grateful for the change of topic. The island's powerful riptide deflects the frigid Labrador current into the warm Cape Cod current, and where they mix you get a large eddy of fog. Sometimes only a thin ring of fog surrounds the island. Other times it's totally sucked in.
What more could a pirate ask for? Needleman murmured.
It won't be long now, Hatch thought.
He tried to lose himself in the hissing of water racing along the chine, the briny scent of the air, the cool brass of the wheel against his palms. He glanced at Needleman and saw a muscle twitching in his set jaw. He was also experiencing a powerful emotion, of another, though no less private kind. The patch of fog drew closer. Hatch struggled in silence, willing himself to keep the boat pointed in the direction of the creeping fingers of mist, so strangely alien on a horizon that had otherwise grown clear. He eased down the throttle as the boat nosed its prow into the murk. Suddenly, clamminess surrounded them. Mallon could feel droplets of condensation begin to form on his knuckles and along the back of his neck. He strained to see through the fog. A dark, distant outline seemed to appear, only to vanish again. He cut the throttle further. In the relative quiet, he could now hear the sound of surf and the ringing of the Ragged Island bell buoy, warning mariners away from its treacherous reefs. He swung the boat in a more northerly course to bring it around the leeward end of the island. Suddenly, A ruined iron derrick loomed above the mists about 200 yards off the port side, twisted by storms, streaked with rust. With a short intake of breath, Needleman swiftly raised the binoculars to his eyes, but the boat had plunged into another patch of fog and the island disappeared once again. A chill wind had picked up, and a light drizzle began to fall. "Can we get closer?" Needleman murmured. Hatch steered the boat toward the reefs. As they entered the lee of the island, the surf dropped along with the wind. Abruptly they broke through the circle of mist, and the island stood revealed in its entirety. Hatch brought the boat parallel to the reef. In the stern, Needleman kept the binoculars glued to his face, forgotten pipe clenched between his teeth, his shoulders darkening in the rain. Bringing the bow into the sea, Hatch threw the boat into neutral and let it drift. Then at last, he turned toward the island to face it himself. Chapter 4. The dark, terrible outline of the island, so persistent in memory and nightmare, was now once again before him in reality. It was little more than a black silhouette etched hard against the gray of sea and sky, shaped like a peculiar tilted table, a gradual incline rising from the leeward to sharp bluffs on the seaward coast, punctuated by a hump of land in the center. The surf pounded the bluffs and boiled over the sunken ledges that ringed the island, leaving a scurf of foam that trailed like the wake of a boat. It was, if anything, even bleaker than he remembered. Wind-swept, barren, a mile long and 800 yards wide. A single deformed spruce stood above the cobbled beach at the lee end of the island, its top exploded by an old lightning strike, its crabbed branches raised like a witch's hand against the sky. Everywhere great ruined hulks of infernal machines rose from the waving sawgrass and tea roses. Ancient steam-driven compressors, winches, chains, boilers. A cluster of weather-beaten shacks sat to one side of the old spruce, listing and roofless. At the far end of the beach, Hatch could make out the smooth, rounded forms of the whalebacks that he and Johnny had clambered over more than 25 years before. Along the nearest rocks lay the shattered carcasses of several large boats, dashed and battered by countless storms, their decks and ribbing split and scattered among the granite boulders. Weather-beaten signs, posted every 100 feet above the high-water mark, read, "Warning. Extreme danger. No landing." For a moment, Needleman was speechless. "At last," he breathed. The moment stretched into minutes as the boat drifted. Needleman lowered his binoculars and turned toward Hatch. "Doctor?" he inquired. Hatch was bracing himself on the wheel, riding out the memory. Horror washed over him like seasickness as the drizzle splattered the pilot house windows and the bell buoy tolled mournfully in the mists. But mingled with the horror was something else, something new, the realization that there was a vast treasure down there, that his grandfather had not been a complete fool who destroyed 3 generations of his family for nothing. In a moment he knew what his decision had to be, the final answer that was owed to his grandfather, his father, and his brother. "Dr. Hatch?" Needleman asked again, the hollows of his face glistening with the damp. Hatch took several deep breaths and forced himself to relax his desperate grip on the wheel. "Circle the island?" he asked, managing to keep his voice even. Needleman stared at him another moment, then he simply nodded and raised the binoculars again. Easing the throttle open, Hatch swung seaward, coming out of the lee and turning into the wind. He proceeded under low engine, keeping the boat at 3 knots, looking away from the whalebacks and the other, more dreadful landmarks he knew would lie just beyond. "It's a hard-looking place," Needleman said. "Harder than I'd ever imagined." "There's no natural harbor," Hatch replied.
The place is surrounded by reefs, and there's a wicked tide rip. The island's exposed to the open ocean, and it gets hammered by nor'easters every fall. So many tunnels were dug that a good part of the island is waterlogged and unstable. Even worse, some of the companies brought in explosives. There's unexploded dynamite, blasting caps, and God knows what else beneath the surface, just waiting to go off. "What's that wreck?" Needleman said, pointing at a massive, twisted metal structure rearing above the seaweed-slick rocks. "A barge left over from my grandfather's day. It was anchored offshore with a floating crane, got caught in a nor'easter, and was thrown on the rocks. After the ocean got through with it, there wasn't anything left to salvage. That was the end of my grandfather's effort." "Did your grandfather leave any records?" Needleman asked. "My father destroyed them." Hatch swallowed hard. "My grandfather bankrupted the family with this island, and my father always hated the place and everything about it. Even before the accident." His voice trailed off, and he gripped the wheel, staring straight ahead. "I'm sorry," Needleman said, his face softening. "I've been so wrapped up in all this that I sometimes forget your personal tragedy. Forgive me if I've asked any insensitive questions." Hatch continued gazing over the ship's bow. "It's all right." Needleman fell silent, for which Hatch was grateful. Nothing was more painful than hearing the usual platitudes from well-meaning people, especially the one that went, "Don't blame yourself. It wasn't your fault." The Plain Jane rounded the southern end of the island and went broadside to the swell. Hatch gave it a little more throttle and plunged ahead. "Amazing," Needleman muttered, "to think that only this small island of sand and rocks separates us from the largest fortune ever buried." "Careful, Captain," Hatch replied, putting what he hoped was a playful tone on the warning. "That's the kind of rapturous thinking that bankrupted a dozen companies. Better to remember the old poem. Because, though free of the outer court I am, this temple keeps her shrine sacred to heaven. Because, in short, she's not and never can be mine." Needleman turned to him. "I see you've had time to do a little extracurricular reading beyond Gray's Anatomy and the Merc Manual. Not many bone cutters can quote Coventry Patmore." Hatch shrugged. "I enjoy a bit of poetry here and there. I sip it like a fine port. What's your excuse?" Needleman smiled briefly. "I spent more than 10 years of my life at sea. Sometimes there's precious little else to do but read." A coughing sound suddenly broke from the island. It grew louder, turning into a low rumble and finally breaking into a throaty, heaving groan like the dying sound of some deep-sea beast. Hatch felt his skin crawl. "What in blazes is that noise?" Needleman asked sharply.
"Tide's changing," Hatch replied, shivering slightly in the raw, wet air. "The water pit is apparently connected to the sea by a hidden flood tunnel. When the rip current changes and the flow in the tunnel reverses, you hear that noise. At least, that's one theory." The moan continued, slowly subsiding into a wet stutter before dying away completely. "You'll hear another theory from the local fishermen," Hatch said. "Maybe you notice that there aren't any lobster pots around the island. Don't think that's from any lack of lobsters."
"The Ragged Island curse," Needleman said, nodding, a sardonic look in his eyes. "I've heard of it." There was a long silence while Needleman looked down at the deck. Then he slowly raised his head. "I can't bring your brother back to life," he said. "But I can promise you this. We will learn what happened to him." Hatch waved his hand, made speechless by a sudden overflow of emotion. He turned his face to the open pilot house window, grateful for the concealing presence of the rain. Quite suddenly,
He realized he could not bear to spend any more time at the island. He nosed the boat westward without explanation, opening the throttle as they once again entered the encircling mantle of mist. He wanted to return to his motel room, order an early lunch, and wash it down with a pitcher of Bloody Marys. They broke through the mist into the welcoming gleam of daylight. The wind picked up, and Hatch could feel the droplets of moisture begin to evaporate from his face and hands. He did not look back, but the simple knowledge that the fog-bound island was quickly shrinking into the horizon eased the constricting feeling in his chest. "You should know that we'll be working closely with a first-rate archaeologist and a historian," Needleman said at his side. "The knowledge we'll gain about 17th-century engineering, high seas piracy and naval technology. Perhaps even about Red Ned Occam's mysterious death will be of incalculable value. This is as much an archaeological dig as a treasure reclamation." There was a brief silence. "I'd want to reserve the right to stop the whole show if I felt conditions were growing too dangerous," Hatch said. "Perfectly understandable. There are 18 clauses in our boilerplate land lease contract. We'll just add a 19th. "And if I become part of this," Hatch said more slowly, "I don't want to be a silent partner, looking over anyone's shoulder." Needleman stirred the dead ashes of his pipe. "Salvage of this sort is an extremely risky business, especially for the layman. What role do you propose to play?" Hatch shrugged. "You mentioned that you'd hired an expedition doctor." Needleman stopped stirring his pipe long enough to look up and raise his eyebrows. "As required by Maine law, are you suggesting a change of personnel?"
"Yes."
Needleman smiled. "And you're comfortable taking leave from Mount Auburn Hospital at such short notice?"
"My research can wait. Besides, we aren't talking about all that long. It's already the end of July. If you're going to do this, it'll have to be over and done within 4 weeks, for better or worse. The dig can't continue into storm season."
Needleman leaned over the side of the boat and knocked the dottle from his pipe with a single hard stroke. He straightened up again, the long dark line of burnt head framing the horizon behind him. "In 4 weeks, it will be over," he said. "Your struggle and mine." Chapter 5 Hatch parked the car in the dirt lot next to Bud's Superette. It was his own car this time, and it was strangely unsettling to be viewing his past life through the windshield of a vehicle so much a part of his present. He glanced at the cracked leather seats, at the faded coffee stains on the burled walnut of the gearbox. So familiar, and somehow so safe. It took a supreme effort to open the door. He plucked the sunglasses from the dash, then put them back. The time for dissembling was over. He looked around the small square. More stone cobbles were peeping up through the worn asphalt of the street. The old newsstand at the corner, with its wobbly wire racks of comic books and magazines, had given way to an ice cream shop. Beyond the square, the town fell away down the hill, as impossibly picturesque as ever, the slate and cedar shingled roofs gleaming in the sunlight. A man walked up from the harbor in rubber boots, a slicker over his shoulder. A lobster man coming back from work. The man glanced at Hatch as he passed, then disappeared down a side lane. He was young, no more than 20, and Hatch realized the man wasn't even born when he had left town with his mother. An entire generation had grown up in his absence, and no doubt an entire generation had died, too. He suddenly wondered if Bud Rowell was still alive. Superficially, Bud's Superette looked exactly as he remembered it. The green screen door that didn't shut properly, the ancient Coca-Cola sign, the weathered, tilting porch. He stepped inside,
worn floorboards creaking under his feet, and pulled a cart from the small rack by the door, grateful for the emptiness of the place. Moving down the narrow aisles, he began picking up some food for the Plain Jane, where he'd decided to stay until the old family house could be readied for him. He poked around, dropping necessities into the cart here and there, until at last he realized he was just delaying the inevitable. With an effort, he pushed the cart toward the front of the store and found himself face to face with Bud Rowell, large, bald, and cheerful, in a crisp butcher's apron. Many times, Hatch remembered Bud slipping him and Johnny forbidden red licorice sticks under the counter. It drove their mother crazy. "Afternoon," said Bud, his glance moving over Hatch's face and then drifting to the car parked outside, checking the plates. It wasn't often that a vintage Jaguar XKE pulled into the Superette's lot. "Up from Boston?" Hatch nodded, still uncertain how best to do this.
"Yep."
"Vacation?" Bud asked, carefully placing an artichoke into the bag, arranging it with deliberation, and ringing it up on the old brass machine with his usual glacial slowness. A second artichoke went into the bag.
"No," said Hatch. "Here on business."
The hand paused. Nobody ever came to Stormhaven on business. And Bud, being the professional gossip that he was, would now have to find out why. The hand moved again.
"Yeah," said Bud.
"Business." Hatch nodded, struggling with a reluctance to drop his anonymity. Once Bud knew, the whole town would know. Shopping at Bud's Superette was the point of no return. It wasn't too late to just gather up his groceries and get out, leaving Bud none the wiser. The alternative was painful to contemplate. Hatch could hardly bear to think about the whispered revival of the old tragedy, the shaking of heads and pursing of lips. Small towns could be brutal in their sympathy. The hand picked up a carton of milk and inserted it into the bag.
"Salesman?"
"Nope." There was a silence while Bud, going even slower now, placed the orange juice next to the milk. The machine jingled with the price.
"Just passing through," he ventured.
"Got business right here in Stormhaven." This was so unheard of that Bud could stand it no more.
"And what kind of business might that be?"
"Business of a delicate nature," Hatch said, lowering his voice. Despite his apprehensions, the consternation that gathered on Bud's brow was so eloquent that Hatch had to hide a smile.
"I see," Bud said. "Staying in town?"
"Nope," Hatch said, taking a deep breath now.
"I'll be staying over across the harbor.
In the old Hatch place." At this, Bud almost dropped a stake. The house had been shut up for 25 years. But the stake went in, the bags were finally filled, and Bud had run out of questions. At least, polite ones.
"Well," said Hatch, "I'm in a bit of a hurry. How much do I owe you?"
$31.25, Bud said miserably. Hatch gathered up the bags. This was it. If he was going to make a home in this town, even temporarily, he had to reveal himself. He stopped, opened one bag, and poked his hand in. "Excuse me," he said, turning to the second bag and rummaging through it. "Haven't you left something out?"
"I don't believe so," Bud said stolidly.
"I'm sure you have," Hatch repeated, taking things back out of the bags and laying them on the counter.
"It's all there," Bud said, a shade of main truculence creeping into his voice.
"No, it's not." Hatch pointed at a small drawer just below the countertop. "Where's my free licorice stick?" Bud's eyes went to the drawer, then followed Hatch's arm back up to his face, and for the first time really looked at him. Then the color drained from his face, leaving it a pale gray. Just as Hatch tensed, Wondering if he'd gone too far, the old grocer exhaled mightily.
"I'll be damned," he said. "I'll be goddamned. It's Malin Hatch."
The color in the grocer's cheeks quickly returned to normal, but his expression remained that of a man who has seen a ghost.
"Well," said Hatch, "have you been, bud?"
Suddenly the grocer lumbered around the counter and crushed Hatch's right hand in both of his.
"Look at you," he said, grasping Hatch's shoulders and holding him at arm's length, a huge grin lighting up his plump face. "To think you've grown up into such a fine, big young man. I don't know how many times I wondered what happened to you, wondered if we'd ever see you again. And by God, here you are, plain as day."
Hatch inhaled the grocer's scent, a mixture of ham, fish, and cheese, and felt both relieved and embarrassed, as if he were suddenly a boy again. Bud gazed up at him a little longer, then glanced back at the licorice drawer.
"You son of a gun," he laughed. "You still eating licorice? Here's one on the house."
And he reached in, pulled one out, and slapped it down on the counter. Chapter 6. They sat in rocking chairs on the back porch of the store, drinking birch beer pop and gazing out over a meadow to a dark row of pines. Under Bud's probing, Hatch had related some of his adventures as an epidemiologist in Mexico and South America. But he had successfully steered the conversation away from his own reasons for returning. He didn't feel quite ready to start the explanations. He found himself anxious to get back to the boat, hang his portable grill over the taffrail, throw on a steak, and sit back with a sinfully dry martini. But he also knew that small-town etiquette required his spending an hour shooting the breeze with the old grocer.
"Tell me what's happened in town since I left," he said, to stop her a gap in the conversation and forestall any probing questions. He could tell Bud was dying to know why he'd returned, but that main politeness forbade him to ask.
"Well, now," Bud began, "there have been some pretty big changes here."
He proceeded to relate how the new addition was built onto the high school 5 years ago, how the Thibodeau family home burned to the ground while they were vacationing at Niagara Falls, how Frank Pickett ran his boat into Old Hump and sank it because he'd had a few too many. Finally, he asked if Hatch had seen the nice new firehouse.
"Sure have," said Hatch, secretly sorry that the old wooden one-berth house had been torn down and replaced with a metal-sided monstrosity.
"And there's new houses springing up all over the place."
"Some are people."
Bud clucked disapprovingly, but Hatch knew perfectly well there wasn't any complaining at the cash register. Anyway, Bud's idea of houses springing up everywhere translated to 3 or 4 summer houses on Breed's Point, plus some renovated inland farmhouses and the new bed and breakfast. Bud concluded with a sad shake of his head.
"It's all changed around here since you left. You'll hardly recognize the place."
He rocked back in his chair and sighed.
"So, you're here to sell the house?"
Hatch stiffened slightly.
"No, I've come to live here.
For the rest of the summer, anyway."
"That right?" Bud said. "Vacation?"
"I already told you," Hatch said, trying hard to keep his tone light. "I'm here on a rather delicate business matter. I promise you, Bud, it won't be a secret long."
Bud sat back, slightly offended.
"You know I wouldn't have any interest in your business affairs. But I thought you said you were a doctor."
"I am.
That's what I'll be doing up here."
Hatch sipped his birch beer and glanced surreptitiously at his watch.
"But Malin," the grocer said, shifting uncomfortably, "we've already got a doctor in town. Dr. Fraser. He's healthy as an ox. Could live another 20 years.
"That's nothing a little arsenic in his tea wouldn't fix," said Hatch.
The grocer looked at him in alarm.
"Don't worry, Bud,"
Hatch replied, breaking into a smile.
I'm not going into competition with Dr. Fraser. He reminded himself that his particular brand of wit wasn't especially common in rural Maine. That's good. Bud gave his guest a sidelong look. Then maybe it's got to do with those helicopters. Hatch looked at him quizzically. Just yesterday it was. Nice, sharp, clear day. Two helicopters came by. Big things they were, too. Went right over town and headed out toward the islands. Seen them hovering over Ragged Island for quite a spell. I thought they were from the army base. Bud's look turned speculative. But then again, maybe not. Hatch was spared having to reply by the creak of the screen door. He waited while Bud lumbered inside to attend to the customer. Business seems good, he replied when Bud returned. Can't hardly say that, Bud replied. Out of season. Population's down to 800. Hatch thought to himself that this was about the size Stormhaven had always been. Yeah, Bud went on. Kids just up and leave now when they finish high school. Don't want to stay in town. They go off to the big cities. Bangor, Augusta. One even went so far as Boston. We've had 5 kids leave town in the last 3 years. If it weren't for the summer people, or that nudist camp on Pine Neck, I don't think I'd have 2 extra pennies to rub together. Hatch merely nodded. Bud was obviously prospering, but it would have been impolite to disagree with him in his own store. The nudist camp he referred to was actually an artist's colony, located on an old estate in a pine forest some 10 miles up the coast. Hatch remembered that 30 years before, a lobsterman pulling traps had seen a nude sunbather on their beach. The memory of a Maine seacoast town was long indeed. "And how's your mother?" Bud asked. "She passed away in 1985. Cancer." "Sorry to hear that." Hatch could tell Bud meant it. "She was a good woman, and she raised some fine—" "A fine son." After a short silence, Bud rocked back in his chair and polished off his birch beer. "Seen Claire yet?" he asked, as nonchalantly as possible. Hatch waited a moment. "She's still around?" he replied with equal nonchalance. "Yep," said Bud. "Been some changes in her life. And how about you? Any family?" Hatch smiled. "No wife. Not yet, anyway." He put down his empty bottle and stood. It was definitely time to go. "But it's been great visiting with you. I think I'll go and fix myself dinner." Bud nodded and clapped him on the back as Hatch pushed his way through into the store. He had his hand on the screen door when Bud cleared his throat. "One other thing, Malin." Hatch froze. He knew he'd gotten off too easily. He waited, dreading the question he knew was coming. "You watch out with that licorice," Bud said with great solemnity. "Those teeth won't last forever, you know."
Chapter 7 Hatch emerged on the deck of the Plain Jane, stretched, then looked around the harbor through slitted eyes. The town of Stormhaven was quiet, almost torpid under the heavy light of the July afternoon, and he felt grateful for the silence. The night before, he'd washed down the steak with a little more beef-eaters than he'd intended, and he'd woken that morning to his first hangover in almost a decade. It had been a day of several firsts. It was the first day he had spent in the cabin of a boat since his trip down the Amazon. He'd forgotten how peaceful it could be, alone with nothing but the gentle rocking of the waves for company. It was also the first day he could remember without having much of anything to do. His lab was now closed down for the month of August, and Bruce, the bewildered lab assistant, had been sent off to write up initial results under the care of a colleague. The Cambridge townhouse was locked up, with instructions to the housekeeper that he would not be back until September.
and his Jaguar was parked, as discreetly as possible, in the vacant lot behind the old Coast to Coast hardware store. Before checking out of the hotel in Southport the day before, he'd received a note from Needleman. A single sentence, asking him to rendezvous off Ragged Island at sunset this evening. That gave Hatch an entire day to himself. At first he'd been afraid this meant a day alone with his memories. He'd thought of dragging out the watercolors he dabbled with on weekends and hazarding a sketch of the shoreline. But the intention fell away unpursued. Somehow, here on the water, he felt a torpid kind of peace. He had come home to Stormhaven. He'd even approached Ragged Island. He had gazed upon the beast and survived. He checked his watch. Almost 7:30. Time to get started. He cranked the engine and was pleased to hear the big diesel turn over obediently. The deep vibration underfoot, the blub-blub of exhaust fumes, was like a siren song out of the past, at once sweet and painful. He put the boat in gear with a thrust of his hand and pointed the big bow in the direction of Ragged Island. The day was clear, and as the boat cut through the water, Hatch watched its shadow flitting on ahead of him, draped across the water by the afternoon sun. The ocean was deserted except for a lone lobster boat, hauling traps off the coast of Hermit Island. He had come on deck a few times during the day to scan the horizon, half expecting to see activity of some sort in the direction of Ragged Island. Seeing nothing but sea and sky each time, he hadn't been sure whether he was disappointed or relieved. Past the harbor, the air turned cool. But instead of throttling down and grabbing his windbreaker, Hatch found himself cranking the boat faster, turning his face into the wind, opening his mouth to the occasional salt spray as the Plain Jane slapped through the chop. It was somehow cleansing, alone out here. He felt almost as if the wind and water might begin to shake loose the accumulated cobwebs and dirt of a quarter century. Suddenly, a dark shadow appeared ahead, low on the eastern horizon. Hatch throttled back, feeling the old familiar trepidation return. The fog around the island was thinner today, but the outlines were still vague and forbidding, the derricks and winches protruding dimly like the ruined minarets of some alien city. Hatch turned the boat to port, keeping his distance, preparing to circle. Then, on the lee side of the island, he saw an unfamiliar boat, moored perhaps a quarter mile offshore. As he approached, he could see it was an antique fireboat, built of rich brown wood, mahogany or teak. The name Griffin was painted across its stern in severe gold letters, and below, smaller, Mystic, Connecticut. Hatch considered coming alongside, then changed his mind and cut the Plain Jane's engine about 100 yards off. The boat appeared empty. Nobody came on deck to acknowledge his arrival. For a moment he wondered if it belonged to some tourist or trophy hunter, but it was now almost sunset. The coincidence seemed too strong. He stared curiously at the boat. If it was Needleman's command craft, it was an unusual but practical choice. What the thing lacked in speed, it made up for in stability. Hatch felt sure it would ride out any but the heaviest sea, and with fore and aft engines it would be highly maneuverable. The hose reels and monitors had been removed, freeing up a lot of deck space. The davits, tower, and searchlights had been retained, and a computer-controlled crane was retrofitted onto the stern. Hatch's eyes traveled up to the capacious pilot house and flying bridge. Above there was the usual cluster of electronic antennae, Loran and radar, along with additional gear not especially nautical. A microwave horn, satellite dish, air search radar, and VLF antennae. Impressive rig, Hatch thought. He dropped one hand to the instrument panel, ready to give a blast of his air horn. Then he hesitated. Beyond the silent boat and beyond the mist-shrouded island, he could make out a deep, throbbing sound. So low in pitch it was almost beneath the audible spectrum. His hand dropped away as he listened. In a minute he was certain. A boat engine,
distant, but approaching fast. Hatch scanned the horizon until he picked up a smudge of gray to the south. As he watched, he saw a momentary flash as the setting sun hit some article of polished metal on the distant craft. Probably a thalassa boat, he thought, swinging up from Portland. Then, slowly, Hatch saw the smudge separate into two, then three, then six distinct shapes. He waited in disbelief as a veritable invasion fleet approached the tiny island. A huge sea barge steamed toward him, its dark red underbelly revealed as bow waves pulled back across the waterline. In its wake labored a tug, its bow net mossy and glistening, 100-ton floating crane towed behind. Next came a brace of powerboats, sleek and muscular-looking, bristling with electronics. A supply boat followed, heavy with cargo and low in the water. From its masthead flew a small flag of white and red. Hatch noticed that the design on the flag matched the insignia he'd seen on Needleman's portfolio cover just days before. Last came an elegant vessel, large and fantastically equipped. The name Cerberus was stenciled on its bows in blue letters. Hatch gazed in awe over the gleaming superstructure, the harpoon gun on the foredeck, the smoked glass portholes. 15,000-tonner minimum, he thought. In a kind of silent ballet, the vessels nosed up to the Griffin. The larger ships came to a stop on the far side of the fireboat, while the smaller craft came to rest beside the Plain Jane. There was a rattling of chains and singing of hawsers as anchors ran out. Gazing at the powerboat straddling his port and starboard sides, Hatch could see the occupants staring back. A few smiled and nodded. In the closest boat, Hatch noticed a man with iron-gray hair and a plump white face looking at him with an expression of polite interest. He wore a bulky orange life preserver over a carefully buttoned suit. Next to him lounged a young man with long, greasy hair and a goatee, dressed in Bermuda shorts and a flowered shirt. He was eating something out of a white paper wrapper, and he gazed back at Hatch with a kind of insolent disinterest. The last engine was cut, and a strange, almost spectral silence fell over the gathering. Hatch looked from boat to boat and noticed that everyone's eyes were gravitating toward the empty deck of the fireboat in the center. A minute passed, then two. At last a door in the side of the pilot house opened, and Captain Needleman emerged. Silently he walked to the edge of the railing and stood, ramrod straight, gazing out at the company that surrounded him. The setting sun gave a burgundy cast to his sunburned face and kindled his fair, thinning hair into gold. It was amazing, Hatch thought, how his slender presence projected out over the water and the circle of boats. As the silence gathered, another man, small and wiry, stepped unobtrusively out of the door behind Needleman and remained standing in the background, hands folded. For a long moment, Needleman remained silent. At last he started to speak, in a voice that was low, almost reverent, yet carried easily over the water. "We live in an era," Needleman began, "when the unknown is known, and most of Earth's mysteries have been solved. We have gone to the North Pole, scaled Everest, flown to the moon. We have broken the bonds of the atom and mapped the abyssal plains of the oceans. Those who tackled these mysteries often endangered their lives, squandered their fortunes, and risked everything they held dear. A great mystery can only be solved at a high price. Sometimes, the highest price." He gestured in the direction of the island. "Here, a mere 100 yards away, lies one of those great riddles. Perhaps the greatest still left in North America. Look at it. It looks like nothing, a hole in a patch of dirt and rock. And yet this hole, this water pit, has sucked the living marrow from the bones of everyone who tried to plumb its secrets. Many millions of dollars have been spent. Lives have been ruined and even lost.
There are those among us today that have felt firsthand just how sharp the teeth of the water pit can be. Needleman looked around at the company gathered on the assembled boats. His eyes met Hatch's. Then he began again. Other enigmas of the past. The monoliths of Sacsahuaman, Easter Island's statues, the standing stones of Britain, cloak their meaning in mystery. Not so the water pit. Its location, its purpose, even its history is known. It lies here before us, a brazen oracle, daring to take on all comers. He paused another moment. By 1696, Edward Ockham had become the most feared pirate cruising the high seas. The ships in his treasure fleet were swollen with accumulated loot, sluggish, low in the water. The next storm, even an unlucky meeting with a man of war, could deal his fleet a mortal blow. He had held off hiding his treasure, and he was now desperate. A chance encounter with a certain architect provided the answer. Needleman leaned on the rail, the wind stirring his hair. Ockham seized that architect and charged him with designing a pit to house the treasure. A pit so fearfully impregnable that it would stymie even the most well-equipped treasure hunter. Everything went according to plan. The pit was built, the treasure stored. And then, as the pirates set out for another round of murder and depredation, Providence struck. Red Ned Ockham died. Since that day his treasure has slumbered at the bottom of the water pit, waiting for the time when technology and human resolve would finally bring it once again into the world. Needleman took a deep breath. Despite the enormous value of this treasure, the best efforts of one man after another have failed to pluck anything of value from the pit. Anything but this. And suddenly the captain held his arm aloft, something gripped between his fingers. The light of the setting sun winked and played so dazzlingly across it that his fingertips seemed to burn. Murmurs of wonder and surprise rippled across the company. Hatch leaned over the railing to get a better look.
My God, he thought. That must be the gold, cored up by the gold seeker's drill over 100 years ago.
Needleman held the curl of gold over his head, motionless, for what seemed a long time. Then he spoke again. There are some who say there is no treasure at the bottom of the water pit. To those doubters I say, gaze upon this. As the dying sun lit water and vessel a dusky rose, he turned to face the forward windows of the Griffin's pilot house. Picking up a small hammer, he placed the piece of gold against the roofline of the pilot house and with a single blow drove it against the wood with a nail. He stepped away to face the company once again, the gold glittering from the superstructure. "Today," he said, "the rest of Ockham's treasure remains at the bottom of the pit, unvexed by sun or rain, undisturbed for 300 years. But tomorrow marks the beginning of the end of that long rest, because the key that was lost has been found again, and before the summer is over, the treasure will sleep no longer." He paused to survey the crowd of vessels. "There is much to do. We must remove the litter of past failure and make the island safe again. We must determine the location of the original pit. We must then find and seal the hidden underwater channel that allows seawater to enter. We must pump the existing water from the shaft and secure it for the excavation of the treasure chamber. The challenge is vast, but we come equipped with technology more than adequate to handle the challenge. We are dealing with perhaps the most ingenious creation of the 17th century mind. But the water pit is no match for 20th century tools. With the help of all who are assembled here today, we will make this the greatest and most famous salvage in history."
A cheer began to break out, but Needleman silenced it with an open hand. "We have among us today Dr. Malin Hatch. It is through his generosity this endeavor was allowed to proceed, and he more than anyone knows that we're here today for more than just gold. We're here for history. We are here for knowledge, and we are here to make sure that, at long, long last, the ultimate sacrifices of those brave souls who came before us will not have been in vain." He bowed his head a brief moment, then stepped back from the railing. There was a scattering of applause, a thin waterfall of sound skipping over the waves, and then, in an instant, the company erupted into a spontaneous cheer, arms lifted above heads, caps thrown in the air, a cry of excitement and eagerness and jubilation rising in a joyous circle around the griffin. Hatch realized he was cheering too, and as a single tear trickled down his cheek, he had the absurd feeling that Johnny was peering over his shoulder, watching the proceedings with wry interest, longing in his youthful way to finally be laid to rest. Chapter 8. A day later, Hatch stood at the helm of the Plain Jane, watching the preparations going on around him. Almost despite himself, he felt a sense of mounting excitement. At his side, two communications monitors, a closed-band scanner covering all the expedition's channels, and a radio tuned to the dedicated medical frequency, emitted occasional chirps and squawks of conversation. The ocean was calm, with only the barest swell, and there was a gentle offshore breeze. The perpetual mist was thin today, gauzy linen loosely encircling the island. It was a perfect day for offloading, and Captain Needleman was making the most of it. Although the Plain Jane was anchored in the same spot as the night before, just outside the ragged island reef, the landscape had changed dramatically. Setup had begun shortly after sunset and escalated at daybreak. The huge sea barge was now anchored 2 points off the eastern shore by massive chains, bolted into the rocky seafloor by Needleman's dive team. As Hatch watched, the 100-ton floating crane was being moored off the western end of the island, its long hydraulic rig hanging over the shoreline like a scorpion's tail, ready to pluck off the rack of 200 years of treasure hunting. Lying in its shadow was the Griffin, Needleman's command ship. Hatch could just make out the captain's stiff, narrow figure on the flying bridge, closely supervising the proceedings. The large research vessel, the Cerberus, remained beyond the circle of mist, silent and still, as if not deigning to approach land. The 2 launches, named the Naiad and the Grampus, had dropped crews on the island early in the morning. Now the boats were busy offshore. From the pattern of the Naiad's movements, Hatch could tell she was plotting the sea floor. The Grampus was taking readings of the island itself, using equipment he was not familiar with. Hatch continued scanning the activity around him until his gaze fell at last upon the island itself. He still felt a kind of sickness in his gut when he looked at it. Perhaps it was a sickness that would never go away. But he had made his decision, and that in itself lifted a huge burden from his shoulders. Every morning now, he awoke more certain that his decision had been the right one. The night before, he'd even caught himself speculating over what he could do with close to $1 billion. Then and there, he'd made up his mind. He would put all of it, every penny, into a foundation in his brother's name. A sudden flicker of white on the island briefly caught his eye before disappearing again into the mists. Somewhere, he knew, crews were already on the move, locating old pits, roping safe trails, tagging ancient junk hidden by the tall brush for later removal. "Tall nettles," Hatch quoted to himself, "cover up as they have done these many springs, the rusty harrow, the plow long worn out, and the roller made of stone." Other teams, he knew, were taking corings from beams in the countless cribbed shafts.
These corings would be carbon-14 dated in the Cerberus lab to determine their age in an attempt to pinpoint which shaft was the original water pit. He pulled out his binoculars and swung them slowly across the terrain until he located one of the teams, pale apparitions in the mist. They were spread out in a ragged line, moving slowly, hacking away at the choke cherries with brush hooks and axes, stopping occasionally to take photographs or scribble notes. One man swept a metal detector in an arc ahead of him. Another probed the ground with a long, narrow instrument. At the head of the group, he noticed German Shepherd diligently sniffing the ground. Must be trained to smell high explosive, Hatch thought to himself. There were, all told, perhaps 50 people bustling on and around the island. All Thalassa employees, and all highly paid. Needleman had told him that, outside of the core half-dozen or so that would receive actual shares of the profits instead of salary, the average worker would earn $25,000. Not bad, considering that the majority would be gone from the island within a fortnight, once the various installations were complete and the island stabilized. Hatch continued scanning the island. At the safe northern end of the island, the only area one could walk without fear, a pier and dock had gone up. Beside it, the tug was offloading a welter of equipment. Crated generators, acetylene tanks, compressors, electronic switching equipment. Already on shore were orderly piles of angle iron, corrugated tin, lumber, and plywood. A tough-looking little all-terrain vehicle with bulbous tires was towing a trailer load of equipment up the improvised path. Nearby, a group of technicians was beginning the work of wiring an island phone system, while another was erecting Quonset huts. By tomorrow morning, one of them would be Hatch's new office. It was amazing how fast things were happening. Still, Hatch was in no hurry to set foot on Ragged Island. Tomorrow's plenty soon enough, he thought. A loud clatter echoed toward him as a heavy piece of equipment was loaded onto the pier. Sound carried well across water. Hatch knew that, even without Bud Rowell's assistance, all of Stormhaven must now be buzzing with news of his return and the sudden flurry of activity on the island. He felt a little guilty that he hadn't been able to tell Bud the whole story 2 days before. By now he'd certainly figured it out. Idly, Hatch wondered what people were saying. Perhaps some of the townspeople suspected his motives. If so, let them. He had nothing to be ashamed of. Even though his grandfather's bankruptcy had relieved his family of legal responsibility, his father had paid off, painfully, over many years, all the family's local debts. There had been no finer man than his father, and that fineness of character made his grotesque, pathetic end that much more painful. Hatch turned away from the island, refusing to follow the line of thought any further. He checked his watch. 11 o'clock. The main lunch hour. He went below decks, raided the gas-powered refrigerator, and returned with a lobster roll and a bottle of ginger ale. Climbing into the captain's chair, he propped his feet on the binnacle and dug avidly into the roll. Funny thing about sea air, he thought to himself. Always makes you hungry. Maybe he ought to research that particular nugget for the Journal of the American Medical Association. His lab assistant Bruce could use a good dose of salt air. Or any air, for that matter. As he ate, a seagull landed on the thrum cap and eyed him quizzically. Hatch knew lobster men hated seagulls, called them wharf rats with wings, but he'd always had a fondness for the loud-mouthed, garbage-swilling birds. He flicked a piece of lobster into the air. The gull caught it and then soared off, chased by two other gulls. Soon all three had returned and were perched on the taffrail, staring him down with hungry black eyes. Now I've done it, Hatch thought, good-naturedly plucking another piece of lobster from the roll and tossing it toward the middle bird. In an instant all three birds tore into the air with a desperate beating of wings. Hatch's amusement turned to surprise as he noticed they weren't after the lobster, but were instead fleeing the boat as fast as they could, heading toward the mainland. In the sudden hush left by their departure,
he heard the chunk of lobster hit the deck boards with a soft splat.
As he gazed after the birds, frowning, he felt a convulsive shudder pass under his feet. He leaped out of the chair, thinking the anchor cable had parted and the Plain Jane had run aground. But the cable was still taut. Except for the thin veil of mist that girdled the island, the sky overhead was clear. There was no lightning. Quickly he scanned the surroundings for any unusual activity. Had they been dynamiting? No. It was too early for that. Then his eyes fell on a patch of ocean, just inside the reef about 100 yards away. In an area some 30 feet in diameter, the placid surface of the water had suddenly broken into chop. A roiling mass of bubbles crested the surface. There was a second shudder, another explosion of bubbles. As they died away, the surface of the water began to move counterclockwise. Slowly at first, then faster. A dimple appeared in its center, almost immediately imploding into a funnel. A whirlpool, Hatch thought. What the hell? A burst of static on the scanner brought Hatch to the railing. There was hysterical shouting on the bands, first from one, then many voices.
Man down! Broke through the riot of sounds. Get the rope around him! Cried another voice. Then, look out! Those beams are about to go!
Suddenly, Hatch's private radio burst to life. Hatch, do you copy? Came Needleman's clipped tones. We've got a man trapped on the island.
Understood, Hatch said, firing up the big diesels. I'm bringing the boat to the pier now.
As a puff of wind blew shreds of mist from the island, he could make out a cluster of white-suited men near the island's center, scurrying frantically.
Forget the pier, Needleman broke in again, a fresh note of urgency coloring his voice. No time. He'll be dead in 5 minutes.
Hatch glanced around for a desperate moment. Then he cut the engines, grabbed his medical bag, and pulled the Plain Jane's dinghy alongside. Tearing the rope free of its cleat, he tossed it into the dinghy, then leaped over the side after it. The dinghy heeled crazily under his sudden weight. Half kneeling, half falling onto the stern seat, Hatch pulled at the starter rope. The outboard leaped into life with an angry buzz. Grabbing the throttle, he pointed the little boat toward the circle of reefs. Somewhere near the south end, there were 2 narrow gaps in the jagged underwater rocks. He hoped to hell he remembered where they were. As the shoreline drew nearer, Hatch watched the water beneath the bow turning from a bottomless gray to green.
If only there was a bigger swell, he thought. I could see the rocks through the breaking water.
He glanced at his watch. No time to play it safe. Taking a deep breath, he opened the throttle wide with a flick of his wrist. The boat sprang forward eagerly, and the green outline of the submerged reefs grew lighter as the water became rapidly shallower. Hatch braced himself against the throttle, preparing himself for the impact.
Then he was past the reef, and the ocean floor sank away again. He aimed the boat at a small pebbled area between the 2 whalebacks, keeping the throttle wide open until the last second. Then he cut the engine and swiveled the outboard upward, raising the propeller above the wake. He felt the shock as the bow of the dinghy hit the shore and skidded up across the shingles. Before the boat came to a halt, Hatch had grabbed his kit and was scrambling up the embankment. He could now hear the shouts and cries directly ahead. At the top of the rise, he stopped. Ahead stretched an unbroken mass of sawgrass and fragrant tea roses, swaying in the breeze, concealing the deadly ground below. This wild southern end of the island had not yet been mapped by the Thalassatine. It's suicide to run across there, he thought, even as his legs began to move, and he was crashing through the brush, jumping over old beams and skittering across rotten platforms and around gaping holes. In a minute he was among the group of white-suited figures clustered around the ragged mouth of a pit. The smell of seawater and freshly disturbed earth rose from its dark maw. Several ropes were wrapped around a nearby winch.
"Name's Streeter," shouted the nearest figure. "Team leader!"
He was the same man who had stood behind Needleman during his speech, a lean figure with compressed lips and a marine-style haircut. Without a word, 2 of the others began buckling a Swiss seat harness around Hatch. Hatch glanced into the pit and his stomach contracted involuntarily. Dozens of feet down,
It was impossible to tell exactly how far. He could see the yellow lenses of flashlight beams. Two roped figures were frantically working at a thick beam. Beneath the beam, Hatch was horrified to see another figure, moving feebly. Its mouth opened. Over the roar of water, Hatch thought he could hear an anguished scream.
"What the hell happened?"
Hatch cried, grabbing a medical kit from his bag. "One of the dating team fell into this shaft," Streeter replied. "His name's Ken Field. We sent a rope down, but it must have snagged on a beam. Triggered some kind of cave-in. His legs are pinned by the beam and the water's rising fast. We've got 3 minutes, no more." "Get him a scuba tank," Hatch yelled as he signaled the winch operator to lower him into the pit. "No time," came Streeter's reply. "The divers are too far offshore." "Nice way to lead the team." "He's already roped," Streeter continued after a moment. "Just cut him loose and we'll haul him up." "Cut him loose?" Hatch thought, just as he was shoved off the edge of the pit. Before he could think, he was swinging in space, the roar of water almost deafening in the confines of the shaft. He dropped for a moment in near freefall, then the Swiss seat jerked him to a rude halt beside the two rescuers. Swinging around, he found a purchase, then glanced down. The man lay on his back, the massive beam lying diagonally across his left ankle and right knee, pinning him tightly. As Hatch watched, the man opened his mouth again, crying out with pain. One rescuer was scrabbling rocks and dirt away from the man, while the other was chopping at the beam with a heavy axe. Chips flew everywhere, filling the pit with the smell of rotten wood. Beneath them, Hatch could see the water, rising at a terrifying rate. He knew immediately that it was hopeless. They could never chop through the beam in time. He glanced at the rising water and made a quick mental calculation. No more than 2 minutes before the man would be covered, even less than Streeter had guessed. He mentally reviewed his options, then realized there were none. No time for painkiller, no time for an anesthetic, no time for anything. He rummaged desperately through his kit. A couple of scalpels, long enough for a hangnail repair, but that was it. Tossing them aside, he began shrugging out of his shirt. "Make sure his rope's secure," he shouted to the first rescuer. "Then take my kit and get yourself topside." He turned to the other. "Stand by to hoist this man up." He ripped his shirt in half. Twisting one sleeve, he tied it around the trapped man's left leg, about 5 inches below the knee. The other sleeve went around the fat part of the man's right thigh. He knotted first one sleeve, then the other, jerking them as tight as possible. "Give me the axe," he cried to the remaining rescuer. "Then get ready to pull." Wordlessly, the man handed him the axe. Hatch positioned himself astride the trapped man. Bracing his own legs, he raised it above his head. The trapped man's eyes widened in sudden understanding.
"No," he screamed. "Please, don't!"
Hatch brought the axe down on the man's left shin with all his might. As the blade drove home, it felt to Hatch for a curious instant as though he was chopping the green trunk of a young sapling. There was a moment of resistance, then a sudden give. The man's voice ceased instantly, but his eyes remained open, straining, the cords of his neck standing out. A wide, ragged cut opened in the leg, and for a moment the bone and flesh lay exposed in the weak light of the pit. Then the rising water roiled up around the cut, and it filled with blood. Quickly, Malin drove the axe home again, and the leg came free, the water frothing red as it churned across the beam. The man threw his head back and opened his jaws wide in a soundless scream, the fillings in his molars shining dully in the glow of the flashlight. Hatch stepped back a moment and took several deep breaths. He clamped down hard on the trembling that was beginning in his wrists and forearms, then repositioned himself around the man's right thigh. This was going to be worse. Much worse. But the water was now bubbling above the man's knee, and there was no time to waste. The first blow hit home in something softer than wood, but rubbery and resistant. The man slumped to one side, unconscious. The second blow missed the first, cutting a sickening gash across the knee. Then the water was boiling around the thigh, heading for the man's waist. Estimating where the next blow had to fall, Hatch positioned the axe behind his head, hesitated, then swung it down with a tremendous effort.
As it plunged into the water, he could feel it strike home, slicing through with a crack and give of bone.
"Pull him up!" Hatch screamed.
The rescuer gave two tugs on the rope. Immediately, it went taut. The man's shoulders straightened and he was pulled into a sitting position, but the massive timber still refused to release him. The leg had not been completely severed. The rope slackened once more and the man slumped backward, the black water creeping up around his ears, nose, and mouth.
"Give me your brush hook!" Hatch yelled to the rescuer.
Grabbing the stubby, machete-like implement, he took a deep breath and dove below the surface of the surging water. Feeling his way in the blackness, he worked his way down the right leg, located the cut, and quickly sliced through the remaining hamstring muscle with the hook.
"Try again!"
he coughed the moment his head broke the surface. The rope jerked, and this time the unconscious man came bursting out from under the water, blood and muddy water running from the stumps of his legs. The rescuer went next, and then a moment later Hatch felt himself hoisted toward the surface. Within seconds he was out of the dark, damp hole and crouching next to the man in a swale of matted grass. Quickly, he felt for the vitals. The man was not breathing, but his heart was still beating, fast and faint. Despite his improvised tourniquets, blood was oozing from the savaged stumps of the legs.
ABC, Hatch recited under his breath. Airway, breathing, circulation.
He opened the man's mouth, cleared out mud and vomit with a hook of his finger, then rolled him on his left side, squeezing him into a fetal position. To Hatch's great relief, a thin stream of water came from the man's mouth, along with a sigh of air. Hatch immediately began a stabilizing pattern. A 10 count of mouth to mouth, then a pause to tighten the tourniquet around the left leg. 10 more breaths, a pause to tighten the other tourniquet. 10 more breaths, then a pulse check.
"Get my bag!" he yelled at the stunned group. "I need a hypo!"
One of the men grabbed the bag and began rummaging through it.
"Dump it out on the ground, for Christ's sakes!"
The man obeyed, and Hatch fished through the scatter, pulling out a syringe and a bottle. Sucking 1 cc of epinephrine into the hypo, he administered it sub-Q in the victim's shoulder. Then he returned to mouth-to-mouth. At the 5 count, the man coughed, then drew a ragged breath. Streeter came forward, a cellular phone in his hand. "We've called in a medevac helicopter," he said. "It'll meet us at Stormhaven Wharf."
"The hell with that!" Hatch snapped.
Streeter frowned. "But the medevac
flies from Portland, and no half-assed medevac pilot can lower a basket while hovering."
"But shouldn't we get him to the mainland?" Hatch rounded on him.
"Can't you see this man won't survive a run to the mainland? Get the Coast Guard on the phone."
Streeter pressed a number in the phone's memory, then handed it over wordlessly. Hatch asked to speak to a paramedic, then quickly began describing the accident. "We've got a double amputation, one above, one below the knee," he said. "Massive exsanguination, deep shock, pulses thready at 55, some water in the lungs, still unconscious. Get a chopper out here with your best pilot. There's no landing spot, and we'll need to drop a basket. Hang a bag of saline, and bring some unmatched O-negative if you have it. But get your ass out here, that's the most important thing. This'll be a scoop and run." He covered the phone and turned to Streeter.
"Any chance of getting those legs up in the next hour?"
"I don't know," Streeter said evenly. "The water will have made the pit unstable. We might be able to send a diver down to reconnoiter." Hatch shook his head and turned back to the phone.
"You'll be flying the patient straight through to Eastern Maine Medical. Alert the trauma team, have an OR standing by. There's a possibility we may recover the limbs. We'll need a microvascular surgeon on tap just in case."
He snapped the phone shut and handed it back to Streeter.
"If you can recover those legs without loss of life, do it."
He turned his attention back to the injured man. The pulse was lousy, but holding steady. More importantly, the man was beginning to regain consciousness, thrashing feebly and moaning. Hatch felt another wave of relief. If he'd stayed unconscious much longer, the prognosis would have been poor. He sorted through his kit and gave the man 5 milligrams of morphine, enough to give him some relief, but not enough to lower his pulse any further. Then he turned to what remained of the legs. He winced inwardly at the raggedness of the wounds and the shattered ends of bone.
The dull blade of the axe was nothing like the nice, neat saws of the operating room. He could see some bleeders, especially the femoral artery of the right leg. Sorting among the refuse of his medical kit, he grabbed a needle and some thread and began tying off the veins and arteries. "Dr. Hatch?" Streeter asked. "What?" Hatch replied, head inches from the stump, using tweezers to fish out a medium-sized vein that had already retracted. "When you have a moment, Captain Needleman would like to talk to you." Hatch nodded, tied off the vein, checked the tourniquets, and rinsed the wounds. He picked up the radio. "Yes?" "How is he?" Needleman asked. "He's got a fair chance of survival," Hatch said, "provided there's no screw-up with the helicopter." "Thank God." "And his legs?" "Even if they recover them, I doubt there's much chance of reattachment. You better review some basic safety procedures with your team leader here. This accident was entirely avoidable." "I understand," said Needleman. Hatch switched off the phone and looked toward the northeast and the nearest Coast Guard station. In 3 minutes, perhaps four, they should see the bird on the horizon. He turned to Streeter. "You'd better drop a marker flare and get this area cleared. We don't want another accident on our hands. When the chopper comes in, we'll need 4 men to lift him onto the stretcher. No more." "Right," said Streeter, his lips tightening. Hatch saw that the man's face was unnaturally dark, blood throbbing angrily in a vein on his forehead. "Tough luck," he thought. "I'll repair that relationship later. Besides, he's not the guy who's going to live without legs for the rest of his life." He glanced again at the horizon. A black speck was approaching fast. In a few moments, the dull thud of heavy rotors filled the air as the helicopter shot across the island, banked sharply, then approached the small group gathered around the pit. The backwash from the blades whipped the sawgrass into a frenzy and kicked dirt into Hatch's eyes. The door of the cargo bay slid back and a rescue platform came bobbing down. The injured man was strapped aboard and sent up, and Hatch signaled for the platform to be sent down again for himself. Once he was safely on board, the waiting paramedic shut the door and gave the pilot a thumbs up. Immediately, the chopper banked to the right and dug its nose into the air, heading for the southwest. Hatch looked around. There was saline already hung, an oxygen bottle and mask, a rack of antibiotics, bandages, tourniquets, and antiseptics. "We didn't have any O-negative, doctor," the paramedic said. "Don't worry," Hatch replied. "You've done okay. But let's get an IV into him. We've got to expand this guy's blood volume." He noticed the paramedic looking at him strangely, then realized why. Shirtless, covered in a crust of mud and dried blood, he didn't look much like a Maine country doctor. There was a moan from the stretcher, and the thrashing began again. An hour later, Hatch found himself alone in the silence of an empty operating room, breathing in the smell of betadine and blood. Ken Field, the wounded man, was in the next bay, being cared for by Banger's best surgeon. The legs could not be recovered, but the man would live. Hatch's work was over. He fetched a deep breath, then let it out slowly, trying to drain the day's accumulated poisons out with it. He took another breath, then another. At last he sank heavily onto the operating table, leaned forward, and pressed his bald fists tightly against his temples. "This didn't have to happen," a cold voice was whispering inside his head. The thought of how he'd sat there on the Plain Jane, idly eating lunch and playing with the seagulls, made him ill. He cursed himself for not being on the island when the accident happened, for letting them proceed before his office and equipment were in place. This was the second time he'd been unprepared, the second time he had underestimated the power of the island. "Never again," he thought, raging. "Never again." As calm slowly returned, another thought insinuated itself into his mind. Today was the first time he had set foot on Ragged Island since the death of his brother. During the emergency, there had been no time to think. Now, in the darkened operating theater, alone with his thoughts,
It took all the self-control Hatch could muster to control the fit of shaking that threatened to overwhelm him.
Chapter 9. Doris Bowditch, licensed realtor, strode briskly up the front steps of 5 Ocean Lane. The old boards of the porch groaned beneath the unaccustomed weight. As she bent forward to try the front door key, a vast assortment of silver bracelets cascaded down her forearm with a jingling that reminded Hatch of sleigh bells. There was a brief struggle with the key, then she turned the knob and threw the front door open with a little flourish. Hatch waited until she had stepped through the door, Moo-Moo billowing out behind, then followed her into the cool, dark interior of the house. It hit him immediately, like a blow to the gut. The same